Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by first responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Welcome to another episode of Life and Sirens. Today, we're talking about some things that may be categorized as rare, but you've probably seen them on the truck. You just may not have known about it. So we're going to get into some disease processes that may be tricky to treat and diagnose in the field, but we do need to do better by our patients. So let's dive in. Jane?
Yeah, in EMS, a lot of times we're trained to treat like big things. Trauma, STEMIs, strokes, respiratory distress. But then there's the weird ones that they fit too many categories, they don't fit any categories, and we get kind of stuck. So if we're not taught to recognize them, then we're going to miss them. And a lot of these we talk about in paramedic school, but it is like a one chart, one chapter situation where you just mention it one day and then you move on to the things that you see more often.
Yeah, like honestly, I feel like there's a rare section and then we spend like 4 hours on it in your entire program, and they're like, cool, put that in your toolbox if you want,
if you remember.
Absolutely. You're like, which organ does this pertain to? And they're like, the kidneys, we don't know, the liver, maybe.
Yeah, who is this named after?
Not sure. So we're gonna go through the field five, which was a fun rascally name that ChatGPT gave these five things.
Thanks, Chat.
So the field five, so we'll start with our first one, which is myasthenia gravis crisis. And this could look like if you get dispatched for generalized weakness, slurred speech, now the patient's having trouble breathing. Initially, you're thinking stroke, but maybe sepsis. But they're on pyrostigmine, and they've had some kind of intubation before. So all of these are red flags for myasthenia gravis. It's a neuromuscular disorder that can suddenly worsen under stress, infection, or certain meds. And it causes a respiratory crisis. So, Obs, can you just give us the basic breakdown of what this disease even is?
Absolutely. So, it's a chronic autoimmune neuromuscular disorder that primarily affects the acetylcholine receptors at the neuromuscular junction. I'm sounding like you over here, James.
Oh, my gosh.
It leads to fluctuating skeletal muscle weakness, and that happens particularly after physical activity.
So, basically, your body has an autoimmune disease, and it's typically your IgG antibodies that are produced against your acetylcholine receptors. And if you remember, throw it back to paramedic school or maybe high school biology, acetylcholine is essentially the neurotransmitter that makes your muscles do muscle things. It can affect those receptors or muscle-specific kinase and then other neuromuscular junction components. But the antibodies, they either block, destroy, or degrade those receptors, which means that your acetylcholine can't bind. And that basically reduces neuromuscular transmission. So then you have decreased muscle contraction, and that leads to fatigable weakness. A lot of times when you see these in general, it would be kind of what I talked about earlier, like extreme fatigue on exertion, or maybe your fatigue and your exertion are disproportionate. But when you end up in a crisis, it's a life-threatening exacerbation. So if you want to go through why it's life-threatening?
Well, I guess let's start with some of the things that might trigger a crisis, which include infection, surgery, stress, medication changes, or pregnancy. Man, I feel like pregnancy, autoimmune, if you get pregnant, something is going to go down.
Absolutely. Truly. Your body is like, what is this thing that's happening? We kind of are prepared for it, but we're also not sure.
Yes. Where is this thing growing in us? We got to get rid of it. So this leads to muscle weakness in a crisis, including your respiratory muscles, to the point of sometimes respiratory failure. So hypoventilation, CO2 retention, hypoxia, and inability to clear urine secretions. So that is a pretty big deal. And I was looking into it. About 15 to 20% of patients who have myasthenia gravis will experience respiratory failure as a result.
That's
at least
wild.
Once.
Oh, wow.
It does suggest that when you have patients that you're like suspicious of this, that you ask them, have they been intubated before?
Yeah.
And that's a good indicator, like where you're headed down this route. Sometimes it can present similar to, like a lot of the disorders that we'll see sludge in.
Yeah.
Except for one of the big differences, and that's mostly just because they can't control secretions. But one of the big differences is it's a flaccid weakness. So a lot of the cholinergic disorders that we see, you have all the acetylcholine, it is bound and it is not unbinding. But this one is that acetylcholine can't bind, so it's not a rigid like paralysis. It's a flaccid weakness that you'll notice, which is different. So what is the treatment for EMS? Well, intubation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you find a patient like this, that is their respiratory muscles are fatigued and they can no longer support their own respirations. It oftentimes requires intubation and mechanical ventilatory support. When they get to the hospital, they're going to get IgG in the hospital. And they'll get corticosteroids to suppress immune activity. And then they'll sometimes use acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. You'll see it, but they want to be very careful with those. Really supportive care is key. The reason this matters for EMS is because it's going to look like a stroke, intoxication, panic attack. But the key differences are the fluctuating weakness. Sometimes there's facial weakness and then the respiratory distress, but they'll oftentimes have clear lungs. So you won't really be able to identify why they're short of breath. And then they will have a history of myasthenia gravis oftentimes. And if they have not already failed respiratory wise, they'll tell you. But if we incorrectly call a lot of these patients that are in this crisis, it's just going to end up with a delay of care. And a lot of times they will tank very quickly and nobody's prepared.
That is true.
Yeah. So that is that's the first one to be afraid of.
You know, I was looking into this and I was like, wow, this is so, so rare. Actually, it's not as rare as I thought it was. Okay.
Uh-oh.
37 per 100,000 people in the U.S.
Oh.
Are diagnosed with this. That's kind of a lot.
Yeah, that's not that rare.
Yeah. I mean, but not a high prevalence of people experience the crisis.
Yeah.
So,
but still, if what it said 50%, so like 15 out of
100,000. 15 to 20%.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That would just be wild.
Yeah, I just thought it was way more rare.
Yeah.
I've never had a patient.
No.
Not that you know of.
That's true.
Dun, dun, right. Dun dun dun. So the takeaway is just that supportive care is really going to be where we're the most useful, and like a good history, because you want the ear to be prepared and calling in this report early. But airway monitoring, oxygenation, and then rapid transport. You can give steroids in a known crisis. Solumedrol or Solucortef is ideal, but if you carry Dex, you can also give Dex. It's just a long-acting steroid, so it won't give like immediate relief, but it still gets on board.
Sweet.
Speaking of steroids.
Oh, yeah. Oh boy. Getting into steroid country.
Oh, yeah. So number two, and we all learn about this a lot in school, is an adrenal crisis. It's also called an Addisonian crisis. And this one's subtle until it isn't.
All right. Let's say that you're on scene with a woman who's dizzy, vomiting, she's hypotensive, and just not bouncing back despite multiple fluid boluses. She's tanned but hasn't been in the sun, and her history includes autoimmune issues or long-term steroid use.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yikes. I bet she feels terrible.
I bet she
Absolutely.
Feels terrible.
So if anybody knows personally, no, I'm just kidding.
This did happen to me last summer.
Oh.
Remember?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it did. You said, uh-oh.
Yeah.
There is a very famous president who had Addison's disease.
Ooh, JFK.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why he was always bronzed. So people don't always look tanned. So if they tell you that they have Addison's disease and they do not look tan, don't tell them they're lying, because sometimes they don't. And it can also be caused by other things. You don't have to have Addison's. It could just be that you've had long-term steroid use. It could be like an adrenal injury that causes an adrenal crisis. So it's an endocrine emergency, and it's caused by a severe deficiency of cortisol, which is our body's primary stress hormone. And it can result from Addison's disease, secondary adrenal insufficiency, like long-term steroid use, sudden withdrawal from steroids, so if you immediately have stopped, or stressors, like infection, trauma, or surgery in someone who has a known adrenal insufficiency. So the patho is basically under normal stress, the adrenal glands are going to produce cortisol, and that helps to maintain your blood pressure, regulate your glucose, and support metabolism. It's also going to modulate immune responses. In someone with adrenal insufficiency, the body can't produce enough cortisol, and during stress, that becomes a critical failure. So it results in profound hypotension, hypoglycemia, electrolyte imbalances, shock, and multi-organ failure, which is basically just like everything.
Yeah, if it can happen, it's going to. Yeah, if that this is untreated.
That we don't want to happen.
Yeah.
So what are some signs and symptoms?
Dizziness, altered mental status, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain is a random one. Obviously the hyperpigmentation, and then fever can happen, or hyperthermia.
Yeah, you can also see, once you're kind of down, like, the treatment path, you can see hypotension that's refractory to fluids. And it would be in a population that you don't necessarily expect that in. So, like, young women or younger people.
It's always the young women. Anytime there's a medical condition, and I think we know why this happens, is just because historically things have just been studied in men. But if it can be a sneaky presentation, it's probably going to be in women.
Oh, for sure. That's just the part that we don't know about because they don't study it.
Exactly.
So what's our treatment?
Steroids.
Yeah, buddy. Which steroids?
Corticosteroids.
Yes. Is there one that's better than others?
Solu-Cortef, dexamethasone. Those are kind of the big two. A lot of places on the trucks, we just have dex. But we used to have Solu-Cortef. We have Solu-Cortef on the aircraft.
Yeah. Yeah, so hydrocortisone or Solu-Cortef is the gold standard. And then methylprednisolone, which is Solumedrol, is an accepted alternative. And then dex is honestly a good EMS option because it's prevalent. A lot of people carry it. It also doesn't interfere with cortisol testing once they get to the hospital, which is kind of nice.
That is kind of
cool. So they can test.
Because that's their levels. The last thing you want to do.
Right.
Treat it, fix it, and then they'd be like, well, they were just...
Never existed.
It's fine.
Yeah. Fibbing. So... You might be looking at an adrenal crisis, which is an underdiagnosed emergency in patients with Addison disease or chronic steroid use. So keep your suspicions high if you see somebody that is hitting a lot of those boxes.
Yeah.
So our third one that I would say we actually see a lot.
Yeah, this probably depends on
where you work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say we see it a lot, but nobody really knows a lot about it. So the third is a sickle cell crisis. And the reason I think that this is important to talk about is because people get really jaded when they have frequent callers that always call for pain. And anyone that says, like, this is the pain medicine that works for me, we immediately roll our eyes and we're like, ugh.
How do you know that?
You shouldn't know that. But people with sickle cell, if they frequently enter a sickle cell crisis, which I think that you can go into it, like, every couple weeks. Couple months.
It like just depends, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like any other autoimmune or any kind of condition that's changes any part of your body. Some people just have it worse than others, and that's not their fault.
Right. And if you statistically look at people that are treated the most poorly in healthcare, it is going to be people of color, and then specifically women of color.
Yeah.
And they are statistically far more likely to have sickle cell disease almost entirely. So that makes it even harder with pain control, and then also the bias on top of that. So sickle cell is an ischemic pain. So consider that if someone's having an MI and they're telling you that they're having chest pain, nobody is like, do not medicate them. Prove it. There's no way that actually hurts as bad as you're saying it hurts.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
Right? So you medicate pain because it's ischemic pain. Sickle cell crisis is also ischemic pain. So think infarct. But it's in bones and organs, and then add in dehydration, infection, or stress, and everything can go downhill fast, especially if acute chest syndrome kicks in, which we will talk about in a bit.
Yeah, you know, there's four types of crisis, which are vaso-occlusive crisis, acute chest syndrome, like you mentioned, splenic sequestration, and aplastic crisis.
Which one's the most common?
Probably You're aplastic and vaso-occlusive.
For sure. Those are the ones that you're going to see a lot. A lot of, like, extremity pain.
Yeah.
And a lot of times these people have a hard time localizing pain because it really is the stomach.
Everything freaking hurts. So vaso-occlusive crisis, the most common type, is that severe pain in your bones, your joints, your chest, back, abdomen. I mean, it's, like we said, it's pretty global. You have your acute chest syndrome, which we'll go over in a second, but this is life-threatening, and it could mimic some other conditions, so we need to be careful when we're evaluating for that. So some of the most common things acute chest syndrome can be mistaken for are anxiety, pneumonia, and then PE. And a lot of the times, it presents with chest pain, hypoxia, occasionally fever, and cough. So it can kind of get lost in the jumble of things.
And with acute chest, a lot of times you'll see infiltrate on a chest x-ray, which is interesting. And if it's not treated, it can progress to ARDS, a respiratory failure, and multi-organ dysfunction too.
Big bad.
Yeah, no bueno.
Splenic sequestration is the rapid pooling of blood in the spleen leading to hypovolemia and shock. That's why sometimes you'll see sickle cell patients who have had their spleen removed. Sometimes that's necessary.
Yeah, and a lot of times, which I did not know, a lot of times this is how they discover that kids have sickle cell, because they'll have
splenomegaly.
Yeah.
You can feel a spleen. Like, you can almost see it. It's kind of like an enlarged liver.
That's wild.
And then finally, the second most common, which is the aplastic crisis. So a sudden drop in red blood cells. This is usually triggered in these patients by some kind of, you know, viral infection. They've been sick, and now their body, because their cells already aren't working like they're supposed to, are like, well, I'm just tired. I'm just going to slow down. A lot of times those present with the shortness of breath, weakness, those kind of symptoms.
For sure. And the patho behind sickle cell is that under stress, the red blood cells, they will sickle. And so they will, like, literally, like, concave into a, like, half moon almost, and deform. And so that's why these patients are not always in crisis, because it takes a kind of a precursor, not necessarily like an outward stressing event, but like a metabolically stressing event, to cause the sickling. And then the cells, sickle cells, have a really short lifespan. So they only have a lifespan of 10 to 20 days. And then a normal red blood cell has a 120-day lifespan. So your body is, like, almost constantly having to replenish. They occlude capillaries and small vessels, which causes tissue ischemia, severe deep pain, especially in bones, joints, chest, and abdomen. Causes inflammation, hypoxia, and potential organ dysfunction. Over time, a repeated crisis can cause damage to organs, the spleen, the kidneys, brain, and lungs. It's not uncommon to see somebody who has sickle cell on dialysis when they age, because the repeated crises can cause kidney damage relatively easily. So what does that look like in EMS? Like, what are these patients going to present to you as?
Severe pain. Usually, okay, so these patients, they are used to this a lot of the time. So they might be like, I'm in, like, the most pain. 9 out of 10 pain, 10 out of 10 pain, like, but they may be relatively calm.
Yeah, like, they look too comfortable.
Yes.
To be in that amount of pain.
Right.
And it's because they live with chronic severe pain.
Absolutely.
And a lot of times they're like 24 to 48 hours into a crisis before they even call.
Yeah.
And so we look at them and we're like, there's no way you're a 10 out of 10. You're just chilling.
Yeah. And, like, a lot of the times these patients will have time, a hard time localizing pain. I think sometimes as providers, we're like, well, if you can't even tell me where the pain is, like, are you really in pain? I think that's a big problem we have, or you can't see the pain, or they can't describe the quality of pain. We're like, well, if you can't do that, like, you're probably not, which is untrue.
Absolutely. Especially for people with sickle cell.
Yeah.
And as far as, like, how people present to you, most of them, if they are awake and alert, they're going to tell you they have sickle cell, because they know. Unless this is a kid who's not been diagnosed yet, they're going to know that they have it. So, Obs, how do we treat it? What do we do?
Our treatment pre-hospitally is going to be supplemental oxygen. We're going to do IV fluids. I know there's some studies out there that say, like, go ahead and push 2 liters, like, off the bat. Your pain management. And again, this is going to have to be pretty aggressive pain management, because this etiology of pain does require high doses and aggressive pain management. So a lot of times these people will be on high doses of Dilaudid in hospital. Once they get admitted, they will be on repeated high doses of Dilaudid. So
yeah, like dosing levels that normally were like, oh my
gosh, that's like scary. Yeah. Like
yeah.
five.
Yeah, they'll give 2 to 4 milligrams of Dilaudid
an hour.
Yeah, and with normal people, we're like, 1 is scary.
Yeah, I've seen patients when I worked in the ED on like pain pumps, and they can get like up to some of them. It's like 5 or 7 or 10 an hour. It's crazy. It just feels like it feels wrong, but I mean, that's how we work. So if you don't have specific sickle cell pain management protocols, you may need to call for orders for higher doses of things, especially if you don't have some of the medications like Dilaudid, or you just have morphine or whatever it is.
With these patients, you always want to keep a high suspicion of acute chest syndrome, especially if they're telling you that they're in pain, that they're in crisis. These patients know. They will tell you. And you just always want to have that in the back of your mind, because that is a life-threatening event.
So what is this pain? If we were to describe this pain to someone who has never experienced this before, James, how would we be able to verbalize that, I guess?
I
or
feel
conceptualize
like
it.
There's a couple different ways. I think it's hard to equate it because it is such like a severe, deep, like ischemic pain.
Yeah.
But if there's something that we could imagine hurting really bad, imagine breaking your femur and then not getting any pain medication for hours. And that's the kind of pain that these patients live in every few weeks or months. And then they're oftentimes treated with suspicion instead of compassion. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I broke my femur, everyone would be trying to shove Dilaudid into my body.
Yeah.
But a lot of times people are really suspicious of sickle cellers. And so when you're treating it, try to understand that pain, that if you had a multi-bone fracture plus hypoxia plus infection plus infarct, that's the level of severity and pain that these patients are in. And that's the intensity that they live with. And so we should absolutely manage pain.
Treat them to the full extent.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's a really good way of putting it, because it sounds dramatic, but that is truly what's going on. So it really kind of puts it in perspective.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If I had someone that broke their femur, they were hypoxic, they had an infection or a stressor, and then they told me that all their tissues were ischemic,
you wouldn't be like, you're a liar.
I would be panicking. I would be like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oxygen pain control, and just believe them. Trust them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do not let the bias of what society is like kind of turn this condition into keep you from treating your patients appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What's number four?
Number four.
This is one that we probably see a lot, and I think a lot of providers roll their eyes at it, but if only you knew.
So number four is going to be endometriosis with acute complications. And like we already said, this is one that gets massively dismissed. And we're just going to kind of give you an example. A woman in her 20s or 30s calls for severe lower abdominal pain. She's vomiting. She feels faint. And you just kind of write it off as bad cramps, maybe an ovarian cyst, maybe even psych. But endometriosis can be completely debilitating. It can lead to bowel obstruction, internal bleeding, or syncopal episodes from the pain alone. And most of these women have already been brushed off by the system. So we need to make sure that we're being very empathetic.
And I think even in the world of OB-GYN, like, we don't manage pain even close to appropriately or effectively or at all.
No. There are procedures that women have done that they get no pain medication or sedation prior to, that are, like, wildly invasive and painful. But men will have a less invasive procedure, and they will be fully sedated and, like, intubated.
Yeah, like, if you look at, there's one thing you can take a look at, and I know this is just maybe a little bit irrelevant, but, like, men who have, like, cystoscopies done, so a camera inserted through the urethra into the bladder, almost always sedated, like, versed fentanyl sedation. Women will do it bedside in the office without sedation, and they'll just be like, here's some lidocaine jelly. Mm-hmm. That's very common.
Which is wild, because that is the same procedure.
Absolutely it is.
It is the exact same procedure. There's no, like, anatomically, like, a ureter's a ureter. Urethra's a urethra.
It still,
like,
hurts.
It still hurts, yeah.
Whether you're a girl or a boy.
I think the most glaring example we saw of this was when we were in New Orleans for EMS World. and we went to a pharmacy museum, and it was like going through all the time.
It was so cool.
It was so cool. It was such a good museum. But it was showing like all of this like old pharmacy things and like medicine through the years and just like how kind of archaic it used to be.
Oh, yeah. Like different equipment, reusable syringes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we go to the next section, and it is all like OB-GYN. And there was not anything different.
It was
what
the
is
same.
Used today.
It was crazy.
It was the same. The speculum was steel instead of plastic. Honestly, I would argue that it's gotten
better,
I would argue that it's gotten worse. Mm-hmm. They had like birthing chairs and things that were appropriate for your anatomy and physiology when giving birth, and we have like completely gotten rid of those. Oh yeah, it's gotten way worse.
It is wild. It is embarrassing, and I bet there's very few people listening right now that have ever treated pelvic pain with medication in the pre-hospital setting.
And I would argue, maybe not always, but sometimes women are worse.
Yeah.
Like, we're worse at treating pelvic.
Like, oh, get your period.
Mm-hmm. We're worse at treating pelvic pain because we all kind of experience it to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So endometriosis, the kind of background and the patho of it, it's chronic. And it's where endometrial-like tissue grows outside of the uterus. So similar to like when you have an ectopic pregnancy, this is ectopic endometrial tissue. It can grow on the ovaries, fallopian tubes, bladder, bowel, peritoneum, or other pelvic structures. And the ectopic tissue responds to hormonal changes during the menstrual cycle. It inflames, bleeds, and scars just like normal endometrial tissue, except that it has no way to exit the body.
Nope.
And so it causes chronic pain, inflammation, adhesions, which is like the scarring, and organ dysfunction. And so every month, the ectopic tissue swells and bleeds, just like the uterine lining, but in the wrong places. Then your body tries to repair the damage, which leads to scar tissue and a lot of times cysts, especially in the ovaries. And the chronic irritation can lead to nerve sensitization. So not desensitization, but sensitization. And then the patient's pain is significantly increased. And so sometimes the pain actually doesn't match the visual pathology, which is also sucks.
Well, and honestly, too, like, I know we're talking about some rare conditions, but you want to know how rare it's not?
Yeah, it's not.
Oh, God.
1 in 10 women.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So like when we talked about like what myasthenia gravis was, 35 in 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 10 women. So, like, somebody that you know has endometriosis.
For sure. And obviously, again, just like any of these other conditions, different people have different severities of it, you know, depending on where it's affecting. But that's a lot of people. So, like, the chances of you coming across somebody with, like, significant pain because of this or some other complication isn't really that low.
For sure. And so when we talk about this in like the EMS world or like the life-threatening world, most time we don't love to talk about chronic conditions, but people can have acute on chronic conditions. So while most cases with endometriosis involve chronic cyclic pain, some patients do develop sudden severe complications that can become life-threatening. One of which is a ruptured endometrioma, which is an ovarian cyst. And it can cause sudden sharp lower abdominal pain that can sometimes present with syncope, hypotension, or rebound tenderness. And it can mimic appendicitis, an ectopic pregnancy, or ovarian torsion.
Mm. Which is definitely a big bad emergency.
Right. So bladder and bowel involvement can also be a problem. So the adhesions that we talked about, they can kink, constrict, or infiltrate the bowel or bladder wall. That can cause severe cramping, vomiting, distension, or urinary retention. And then hemoperitoneum is rare but serious, and it's an internal bleeding from implants on blood vessels or cysts rupturing on blood vessels. And sometimes it can present with shoulder pain because, like, pelvic bleeding a lot of times will have a shoulder pain.
Curse sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, curse sign.
Good job, Bob.
And
I remember medic school.
These patients with shoulder pain may also present with hypotension, dizziness, or guarding. And then lastly is a severe pain crisis. The pain is said to be, can be worse than labor, even without rupture or bleeding. It's common around menstruation, but not always. And these patients may have nausea, vomiting, anxiety, and tachycardia from the pain. And a lot of times, because we're in that 20s and 30s age range, and it says a typical age range is 15 to 45, so
your whole life.
A menstruating adult, with recurrent cyclical pelvic abdominal pain. So for your entire life, every month you might pass out, you'll feel faint, and nobody takes you seriously.
And the worst part is, like, to figure out that you have it, you have to have a surgical procedure. Like, you have to look inside. No imaging is going to tell you, unless there's some other complication, like the bowel obstruction or you have cysts or whatever. But the definitive diagnosis is surgery. But before you get surgery, they have to prove that you probably have it. So how do you do that? You just have to have a compassionate doctor that's like, I believe you. So yeah. A lot of these people go, sometimes their entire lives undiagnosed.
Yep. And you just have cyst on cyst on cyst rupturing. And doctors are like, yeah, you probably have it, but
take some Tylenol.
Take some ibuprofen. So typically, we talked about the age range, and it's commonly misdiagnosed as GI issues. Some women with endometriosis think they have IBS, but they don't.
Yeah.
It can be misdiagnosed as kidney stones, pelvic inflammatory disease. Some people are just accused of being drug seeking. They're just anxious. They just say it's anxiety. And then lastly is that this is what other women that don't have it will sometimes think, that they just have a low pain tolerance for normal, like, menstrual cramps.
Yeah.
They just think that they're being a big baby. Mm-hmm. And so really the treatment is manage your ABCs. Make sure that we are not hemorrhaging somewhere. Do a proper physical assessment. Manage pain. And really just, like, believe them. If they tell you, like, this is different or this is worse, just believe them.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll see a pain out of proportion to exam. So that's like the, this is worse than usual. And then similar to, not like it's the same etiology, but similar to in sickle cell crisis, where they may look far too comfortable for the amount of pain they're reporting. They're used to chronic pain. And so a lot of times they don't look like it's horrible.
Yeah. Cause they have to go to work, go to school, take care of their kids. I mean,
right.
While doing this,
they have to do all the things. Mm-hmm. And so I've heard it described as a lot of different things for pain and pain control, but I think it helps when we can equate it to something that people might understand. So what is a similar pain experience that we may be able to equate it so that other people that don't have it can understand what it might be like?
I've heard it put that it's like passing a kidney stone, except the stone is invisible. The pain lasts for days and it happens every month, sometimes even in between. And now just imagine you're being told to just breathe through it and it will go away.
Everyone has periods. I don't know why it's so bad for you.
And then go to work.
Yes.
Right. And it isn't just cramping. It is stabbing, radiating, nauseating pain.
Oh, yeah.
And you have that plus bloating, nausea, back pain. You get it regularly. And then a lot of people experience pain with bowel movements and sex when they have endometriosis. And if you can understand all of those things, then you're starting to understand what it might be like. Which is wild.
It is wild.
Mm-hmm. It is wild. And it's so wild that the only real method of treating, they're like, you know what? Why don't you just go ahead and have a baby? Have you heard people say that?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of their recommended treatment modalities. Is get pregnant.
That sounds...
No.
That sounds horrid.
Yeah, like, crazy.
Yeah,
go on birth control. Like,
yeah, get pregnant, go on birth control, hysterectomy.
Yep.
That is... those are your options.
You said we have five things. We are down to number five.
Number five.
What is it?
Scary.
Scary. And is it that uncommon? So, we're going to be talking about our last topic. Is rare, but probably not that rare, is peripartum cardiomyopathy.
Dun, dun, dun.
How rare is it, so?
Well, thanks for asking. It ranges. There's, like, a range because it really depends on, like, where we're getting these stats from, like, the demographic and the country. And it globally, it's insane. But the range is about 1 in 1,300 to 1 in 4,000 live births. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's too many.
That's way too many.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrifying.
Specifically, this occurs in higher incidences in African-American populations, especially if you have any patients specifically from South Africa or Haiti.
Oh.
Like those.
Yeah.
They just have a higher incidence. 1 in 1,000, roughly, for South Africa. And then 1 in 300 for Haitian women.
Wow.
Jeez.
Yeah, so if you have a Haitian mother, you better be highly suspicious that
absolutely
her heart is stressed.
Yeah. I'm wondering if that is genetic or if it's like diet or kind of what, because we're going to go through the patho and you might understand why I might ask that.
Yeah.
Obs, do you want to tell us about maybe how this patient might present?
Yeah. So let's just say that you get dispatched to a woman who is postpartum, maybe a few days, few months. You don't know yet. She calls because she has been tired, short of breath. She's been coughing and her legs are swelling more than normal, but she has been told by everyone around her that it is just stress because you just had a baby.
Yeah, you're up. Obviously. You're not having any sleep. You're running around, so your feet are swollen. I mean, yeah, it's just baby stuff, right?
Just the baby.
Yeah, whatever. It's fine.
Go to bed.
But if you do go to bed, it might be a problem because it could be peripartum cardiomyopathy, which is a form of heart failure that hits women during late pregnancy or postpartum. So like your last month of pregnancy up to right around your 5 months postpartum. It's rare, like we said, but not that rare. And the consequences can be fatal if we miss it. So with the heart failure, you have a reduced ejection fraction that develops in previously healthy women during the last month of pregnancy or within 5 months postpartum. And it's often missed because the symptoms are chalked up to normal postpartum changes. So no one's concerned because they just are like, oh, yeah, this is just how it is after you have a kid.
Exactly. Again, you're just being dramatic. Everybody goes through this.
No. Right? No. Because what's actually happening is, well, this is two parts. The cause is actually unknown. Surprise, surprise. But they do know some indications and have some theories of what is likely to cause it more than other things. It can be caused by inflammation and oxidative stress, myocardial damage due to autoimmunity, hormonal shifts, and vascular dysfunction. There's also a probable link to prolactin metabolites that become toxic to heart muscles, and they're produced in the body primarily for milk production after birth, but it influences immune function and metabolism during pregnancy and postpartum. So under normal circumstances, prolactin, which is this hormone that helps with milk production, it circulates in a full-length non-toxic form. So it's like a straight protein chain. And then under stress, oxidative damage or inflammation, it is cleaved by enzymes into smaller fragments. And then the reason this isn't even an issue, it inhibits the formation of new blood vessels, promotes cell death, and damages specifically endothelial cell and cardiac myocytes.
Ooh. It sounds so positive, but also so negative.
Right?
Promotes cell death.
Promotes cell death.
You mentioned a term, oxidative stress. What is that?
Yeah, it's used a lot in like papers and peer-reviewed papers, and I just took me a while to figure out what it meant. So it's in reference to our favorite free radicals. They're produced naturally in your body, so it's not just an over administration of oxygen that causes free radicals. You are going to produce them naturally, and these free radicals have unpaired electrons, so your body produces antioxidants, which is why antioxidants are important, to neutralize said free radicals. But if there are too many free radicals and not enough antioxidants, it can lead to cell and tissue damage. It matters clinically because it can damage your DNA, proteins, cell membrane, trigger inflammation, impairs organ function, and can lead to diseases that are also long-term. And the reason that pregnancy and oxidative stress really go hand in hand is because pregnancy just basically is oxidative stress. So it's profoundly metabolic and a physiological event. It creates an environment that naturally leads to increased oxidative stress. And the why is that you have an increased metabolic demand that cranks up your oxygen consumption, your energy production, especially at the mitochondrial level. And more metabolism means more free radicals. And the mitochondria create free radicals. The mitochondria create reactive oxygen species as part of making energy. So that's kind of how this all comes full circle. During pregnancy, you also have a lot of stressors on your heart. So you have an increased blood volume and increased cardiac output. It's increased by, can you guess how much your blood volume increases during pregnancy?
Ooh, it's something wild, like 30%?
30 to 50.
Oh my god.
That's crazy.
Which is nuts. So clearly your heart is working harder. Your vessels are stretched and the endothelium becomes more active and more vulnerable. And then you have the placenta. And that guy is doing so many things. It's creating hormones. It's feeding that baby. And it is regulating your immune interactions. It also produces a high level of free radicals because it's doing so much stuff. And then your body is also trying to not kick this fetus out of it, because our bodies don't like things that it was not prepared for. And so immune modulation and inflammation is caused during pregnancy. It's a natural shift of the immune system to tolerate the fetus. These changes include mild systemic inflammation. So any infection, inflammation, or autoimmune condition during pregnancy amplifies the stress. And then we also probably all have antioxidant deficiencies. So some women have lower antioxidant levels, which is why I was curious about the Haitian diet. Like, does it have low levels of vitamin C or something like that? But antioxidants like vitamin C, that's the most common one that we're like, take this when you're sick.
Yeah.
Cause you have an increase in your metabolic rate when you're ill, which is interesting.
Yeah. If you were just out here running around taking vitamin C, cause that's just what you're supposed to do. Now you know.
Now you know why. So why is it dangerous? Doesn't it just cause like a little swelling and then you're all good?
Definitely. No.
No.
Definitely not. So... this is very serious. Leads to heart failure, death. I mean, and it's very under-diagnosed in the most vulnerable population, which is these African-American women. They're more likely to die than anyone because of this condition. And we see a lot of these women who are already have issues like their kidneys, and possibly they are dealing with hypertension in pregnancy and preeclampsia and things like that. So all of these things can also make your likelihood, or you should be looking out for the likelihood of cardiac involvement.
For sure. So, and I feel like those populations also get worse medical care in general, yes. Especially in OB-GYN, which is statistically unfortunate.
Yeah. And I was talking, I think we've all spent some time with this OB, very rural OB, and she will go on a rant about how pretty much all of this, like all the mortality related death in American OB-GYN care, is absolutely preventable if we just actually investigate and assess patients. But pregnancy is one of those things where like, oh, well, you're pregnant, so like that's probably why. Like, I don't know why that's happening, but like, you're pregnant. Or could you be pregnant? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a really good blanket answer.
Yeah,
they just write off a lot of things. It's like, well.
You're pregnant.
And like,
you're a woman.
Yeah, woman body. Pregnant.
It's probably hormones.
Fine.
Which it can be. Hormones do make this happen, but like.
But just remember that hormones don't just mean your mood is off. Like, hormones regulate
our whole body.
Your entire body, yeah. Oh, man. So what are some risk factors for obtaining this? I know you mentioned a few, like preeclampsia, eclampsia, hypertension, but also advanced maternal age.
Yeah.
And I do not know, I'm being so honest with you, I do not know what that is. According, like, is that like 35?
Yes, here it says 35.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm. Geriatric pregnancy. That's what it's called. I'm not even kidding.
After 35?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's called a geriatric pregnancy?
Yes, it is.
God. Rude. They are just throwing stones at every corner.
That is
rude.
It is rude, and it's unfortunately the case.
Geriatric pregnancy.
Prolonged tocheolytic therapy. Yeah.
Prolonged tocheolytic therapy. That is one that it makes so much sense, but I didn't expect it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you're on any like intensive therapies, like at the end of your pregnancy, or trying to make your pregnancy remain in place and safe, then you probably are high risk for everything else.
For sure, absolutely. So if we end up encountering a patient that we are suspecting cardiomyopathy, what are they going to look like?
They'll probably be tired.
Yeah.
Short of breath. They'll probably have some edema, significant pitting edema with lower extremities.
If they're in like respiratory distress, what's a good treatment for them?
BiPAP.
Yeah.
CPAP.
Yeah, so your treatment, especially with peripartum cardiomyopathy, is not going to be that much different than you would treat heart failure. There are some nuances, but especially with respiratory distress, we're going to sit them in high Fowler's. We're going to give them O2, BiPAP, if that is where you think their clinical course is going, cardiac monitor, IV access. Yeah. And some things that you can ask that will kind of give you an indication that this might be an issue is a big one's orthopnea. So if they lay flat and it's worse, you're like, oh, okay. Leg swelling or palpitations. They can have crackles slash rails. Tachycardia and then new fatigue. And these aren't just new mom things.
No, this is like profound, extreme.
Yeah. This is like if a 70-year-old man called you with these complaints, you would say, oh, you have heart failure.
Yeah. If your brain says this sounds like heart failure, you're right.
You're right. It probably is. Because, you know, pregnancy.
Just because you're pregnant doesn't mean you can't have other things happening.
So how do we avoid missing these five and then, you know, every single other rare or maybe less than rare disease or diagnosis that we come across?
I think first and foremost, you listen to your patient, right? Like kind of the theme of this episode has been like, they will tell you. They say that this is different, like listen to them. You're going to have to ask some questions. You're going to have to ask all the questions, really, like really investigate with these patients. Obviously ask all of the regular like OB gyn questions, and then you might have to do a little bit more digging beyond that. And then this one is probably going to be the hardest one to swallow, but know your biases and try to keep them in check as much as you can. That's also been the theme of this episode. Mm-hmm. Women are chronically under-triaged and under-cared for in the medical field, and it's sad.
Yeah, literally half the time women are misdiagnosed, their chest pain is misdiagnosed.
Oh yeah, you gave me a statistic earlier that was like how many MIs are misdiagnosed.
It's 50%.
It's 50% of women that present, you have a 50% chance as a woman presenting to the ER with chest pain of being written off.
Yep.
That is crazy.
That's astronomical in my opinion.
Yes. It's wild.
Like, wild. It really is wild. Is. And I think lots of these biases just come from like undereducation. It's not something we talk about a lot. I think we do in chest pain. Like, it's going to be atypical. They might have the nausea, vomiting. Okay. Mm-hmm. But like, just generally, like, we understudy it, or we study it in male populations, so we just don't have the facts that we need.
Yeah, and historically, diseases were not ever even studied in women. They were only studied in men, and we only started actually studying disease in women in the last, like, 60 years, maybe less.
Yeah.
And especially, no pregnant female wants to be like, I'll volunteer for that study. No one does that, but we don't even do like observational studies that frequently, which is why a lot of the pregnancy disorders were like, we don't know.
Well, studies happen and things that can be funded.
Yep. So a lot of times it starts with science. You have to start actually studying women, especially with air quotes, atypical presentations. It's actually quite typical for women to present certain ways because your bodies are built differently. Your organs are placed differently. Like nausea, vomiting makes sense because in women, your stomach is actually closer to your heart than in men.
Yeah.
And so
we
it's
have
not
a lot of anatomical things we just haven't explored yet. And I'm not sure why.
Right. I'm like,
we've been here for a while.
It's
I'm not sure why.
Almost like the whole time.
Yeah. I'm just like, guys, there has got to be female scientists out there that are like, oh, can we?
I'm sure they are, but they're like, can we have the money to do that?
And they're like, no.
Actually,
No. We need to work on another ED drug.
Absolutely. That is my priority
as well. That's where it's at. That's where it's at.
Why don't we do some trivia? Adrenal crisis is most often caused by which of the following? Long-term steroid use or Addison's disease, hyperthyroidism, preeclampsia, or high cortisol levels?
What is Addison's disease?
Yes, so long-term steroid use or Addison's disease. Okay. Sickle cell disease is most commonly prevalent in which populations? Scandinavian, African-American and Mediterranean, East Asian and Middle Eastern, Eastern European.
Most prevalent is African-American and Mediterranean, but Middle Eastern is actually second. Pretty common as well.
All right. Let's see. True or false? Endometriosis can cause internal bleeding, bowel obstruction, and syncope.
True. All
right. Finally, peripartum cardiomyopathy typically presents within how many months postpartum? 1, 3, 5, or 12?
5 months.
Correct. 5 months. That's it. So stay on the lookout, stay vigilant, and don't write off patients just because your idea of what they should be looking like in that much pain is just not what you're seeing.
Yeah, I don't know why pre-hospital providers, why we are so worried about getting tricked.
Yeah.
I think it's because our assessment and our eyeballs is really all we've got. And we have some equipment, but for the most part, it's like the vibes and your assessment, like your physical assessment. And we feel like when patients send us down a rabbit hole, that it like discredits our ability to assess. And maybe that's like my like logical reason why providers are like this. But it is, it's okay if you get bamboozled because you chose to believe somebody.
Absolutely.
You know, like, don't worry about patients tricking you. If you medicated someone's pain because they said it was 10 out of 10 and they have this history and they appeared to be in discomfort, if that patient turns out to be narcotic seeking, like you still did the right thing.
Yeah, we'll figure it out and we'll decide where to go from there, maybe with a lot more disciplines on board.
With that mindset, the amount of patients that you will improperly treat is actually going to be significantly higher than the ones that you will catch.
Absolutely. I've said this a million times, like, if I give someone a dose of pain medication on the ambulance, I'm not ruining their life. I'm not the one that's ruining their life. Like, I could be hurting them worse by not giving it to them,
potentially. Absolutely.
And we will figure that out in the hours, months, days, and leading forward. So,
yeah.
I just said that in a weird order. I said hours, months, and days.
Days.
You get the picture. We'll figure it out eventually, okay? Sure. We don't have to do it right now.
Yeah. I've had a hard time, too. It took me a long time to realize that it was not a badge of honor to say that it's really hard for you to give, like, to make me give you pain medication. And I used to be that way. I was like, you got to prove it for me to give you pain meds. And I don't know why that was such a thing. But now my threshold for medicating pain is significantly lower.
You know,
but it's still something that I, like, struggle with.
And you know how angry I get when people call other providers who medicate appropriately for pain, how they call them like the Candyman or whatever. Like, I just get really upset with that because first of all, that's really dangerous. And also like you weren't there. So sit down. And just like we say in many other episodes, is the calls that we come across are just luck. So maybe every single one of your calls, you have something that pain management is necessary to treat. So,
absolutely.
Do not judge providers for being compassionate. I will for fight sure. you. And that's
a guarantee.
A guarantee.
Yeah, that is always, it's always a weird conversation. But they're like, oh, so you just give everybody pain meds? I'm like, well, yeah. I medicate people that are in pain.
Thank you guys for listening to another episode of Life and Sirens. We will be here once again next week as well.
And hopefully we'll keep you out of pain.
And yep, that.
3 nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.